Welcome to the Getting Off Course podcast. I'm your host, Josh Waldron, and this is episode number 9. I'm joined today by Sam Puryear, the director of golf at Howard University. Sam has coaching experience at Stanford, Michigan State, and Queen's University in Charlotte. He's a Coach of the Year recipient and has been a part of a national championship team. He's also the author of a book called Diamonds in the Rough. Sam, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you. Good morning.
So I've got a lot of questions for you, and I kind of want to start with your childhood. You grew up in Winston-Salem. Yep. What did life look like for you as a kid in North Carolina?
I was blessed. I had a wonderful mom and dad. I played 4 sports in high school, captain on the golf team, captain on the basketball team. It was a nice, idyllic setup. I mean, I had a younger brother. He was much younger, but, you know, grew up in a nice neighborhood, professional neighborhood, with, you know, parents and neighbors, and neighbors helped rear each other's children. So I feel like I had a really blessed upbringing.
So how did golf become a part of the equation for you?
Great question. So my father was an All-American in college in golf in 1965. So for me, especially when I was young, my dad would, you know, I would see him leaving, going to the golf course. And I would say, hey, can I go? He always said yes. Now, would I always play at the course? I could care less as a little boy. He would just give me literally a handful of money and say they had these great ham and cheese sandwiches and great Tahitian treats and honey buns. And I could stay on the driving range and watch the old men hit balls while he was out playing. And I would have like 1 or 2 clubs, eat my honey buns, eat my cheese sandwiches, listen to their stories. I could do that all day. So for me, I probably enjoy going to the golf course more for the food than the golf in the beginning.
Love it. You know, my dad played hockey when I was younger.
Okay.
And they had this vending machine there with all these great choices. So I would scrape up whatever change I could find at the house, in the car. I would even look under the vending machine. And that was, you know, half the fun, just going to the game.
Sure.
All right. So you head off to college at Tennessee State University. How did you end up there?
Well, at that point, I had had about 8 college offers to play golf. And the offer from Tennessee State sounded, it sounded better than the other ones only because it was the furthest away from my home or the farthest away from my home. So That being the case, I was like, you know what? It'd be nice to go somewhere where I feel like I'm away, like I'm out of state, I'm going somewhere. And, you know, the coach made these promises of playing, competing against some of the best schools in the country and stuff like that. And if I were being honest, I didn't know anything about Tennessee State, but I said, we promised to play good competition, and I'm a long way away from home. So I don't have to worry about my parents coming to check on me. So I said, this seems like an ideal fit. And that's realistically how I got there. I mean, it was no rhyme or reason, no magic, nothing else. And when I look back on it to this day, it's the best decision I've ever made.
Yeah, that's cool that you can look back and view it that way too.
Totally, totally.
So this TSU program that you ended up at was pretty special historically. Your coach, Dr. Katana Starks, was the first woman to coach a D1 men's golf team. I mean, this is such a big deal that they even made a movie about her.
Yeah, the team, you know, it's interesting. The team in the very beginning was slightly dysfunctional because it was very similar or eerily similar to what we're doing right now. How it was brand new.
Yeah.
And, you know, somebody can tell you a program is new, but to be a part of a brand new program, you realize there are going to be hiccups, like transportation. How are you going to get to practice? And it's funny, 30 years later, I mean, there's some of the same hiccups that I've run across here, just in something as simple as getting the van on time through the renting process to keep it for the semester to drive the students to practice, even here at Howard. So
yeah,
we had a couple of hiccups in the beginning at Tennessee State, just, I would say, logistical hiccups. Another issue we probably had in the beginning at Tennessee State, which I don't think anybody, I know the administrative piece, Because I don't think the administrative piece at Tennessee State supported Dr. Starks at all. In the beginning, I know they didn't in the beginning. They didn't support her at all. So she literally made it all happen. She grinded.
Yeah.
She got the course. She developed the course relationships. She got us to practice. She resourced and fundraised and got us money for gear. And so I noticed how hard she worked in order to give us those, you know, give us those opportunity. And now I look at starting a program here, and I don't have any of those same problems. I don't have issues with clubs. I don't have issues with clothing. I don't have issues with course access. We've literally, all of that is in place right now. So for me, it's almost like playing at Tennessee State 30 years ago prepared me for where I am today.
Yeah. Any other things that you want to tell us about Coach Starks? I know that she's had an impact on your life and on the life of others.
Yeah, I love Coach. I love Coach. And so up until the time that, you know, I helped put her casket in the back of that car, man, I mean, I loved her. I mean, she and I talked a ton, like a ton. And, you know, the one thing that you don't realize at 17 when I went to college, because I used to say, man, this lady, she's hard on me. We would go at it. She would be on me, just on my back. But it's funny, as time waned, when I got towards the end of my college career, when I graduated, I realized that she was exactly what I needed. She realized what it was going to take to keep pushing and motivating. She probably realized that some of the stuff she would do and say was going to probably piss me off. But she knew the way I was built, and she knew that would motivate me to just go harder. And so, you know, as our relationship really, really bonded super, super tightly, she was really special to me, and she was special to my family as well.
It's amazing the role a teacher or a coach can play in someone's life. And you know this from being a coach, but it sounds like she was one of those people.
Oh, she was special. No question about it.
So you graduated from TSU in 1992.
Sure.
Did you know that you wanted to coach golf at some point?
No, that never crossed my mind. As a matter of fact, I always wanted to write. And so when I left there, I went to Golf Digest to write.
Okay.
And then I wrote for some different newspapers and different magazines and publications all over the country. And it wasn't until many years later, my younger brother, who's like 9 years younger than I am, he was coaching college football. He coached at a few different universities, and he just so happened to call me one day. He said, hey, he said, I just finished a golf outing with a ton of coaches. He said, the golf coaches were here. He said, I got to be honest with you. He said, you and I have never had this discussion, but have you ever thought about coaching college golf? I said, dude, I don't want to coach college golf. He said, no, I'm serious. I said, man, that's the last thing I want to do. I said, why would I want to coach college golf? He said, I was just out here with these guys, and I'm listening to these people talk. He said, they don't know golf as well as you. He said, second of all, they can't even play. He said, and then all the money you raise and all the development pieces that you do, he said, these folks don't even do it. So we laughed about it. I said, don't worry, bro. I'll never coach college golf. And we laughed, and he continued to coach for years. And literally one day, years later, I sat back and was thinking. I said, I wonder if that's even a decent idea, you know? Because what I had done is, when I went to East Lake, I had helped prepare students to play collegiately. So I was meeting a ton of college coaches. I was taking students to college golf camps, the whole nine yards. And as I would meet these coaches, I would say, man, you know what? I can do this. I'm doing what they're doing. And so when the opportunity opened up at Stanford, when I saw it, at the time I was married, and I called my wife at the time. I said, you're not going to believe this. I said, I just saw my next job.
Wow.
And she laughed and laughed. She said, what are you talking about? You didn't tell me you were applying for a job. I said, I haven't applied for a job. I said, it's just on my heart. I know God. I said, I just saw the opportunity, and God said, that's yours.
Yeah.
And then as it worked out, I ended up going to Stanford, and the rest is history.
That's a pretty big jump, too. I mean, you were an East Coast guy, right? And you end up all the way out there in California.
Yeah, but you know, and that's actually a great point. And only my closest friends realize this. But the first thing I told my close friends is that when I went to the Bay, we got off the plane, I kind of felt like I did in Carolina. Like, you could sense or feel you were close to the mountains. You could sense or feel you were close to the ocean. Mm-hmm. You were in a place where a city was close, but it wasn't too close. And I just kind of felt like, man, I felt like I was at home. It was a, yeah. It was a very comfortable, easy transition. The people at Stanford were absolutely amazing. And I mean, not just from the golf perspective, I mean, the golf coach, Conrad Ray, was fantastic, but I mean, the entire Stanford family, you know, they welcomed me with open arms. I was able to sit down in different people's offices and converse, ask questions. But what I always really respected is that they respected excellence.
Yeah.
You know, if they knew you could do it, there weren't a whole lot of questions. It was like, hey, let's be the best. And that was something I had always prided myself in. So to take my normal makeup and put me in a situation where people want that best was a perfect experiment. It was fantastic.
Yeah. So when I was younger, so this is me as a kid. You know, I'm 36 now, so this is in the 90s. Here's kind of how I viewed golf. I had a few uneducated takes here. So the first take is, it's not a cool sport. So, you know, basketball's cool, but golf, not cool. Second take, it's a rich person's sport. So it's either for rich people or it's for important people. And since I didn't come from either of those backgrounds, like I never stepped foot on a country club. Mm. And then the third take would be, because this is kind of Tiger Woods' heyday. With the exception of Tiger Woods, this is mostly a sport that white people play. Mm-hmm. As time has passed, you know, I've learned that there's some truth in those statements, but I've also learned to view golf in a much broader way. And as I was kind of digging in on your background, it seems like you have a pretty broad view of golf too. So I want you to kind of help me and help the listeners understand how you view the game of golf.
Well, I don't think some of your takes were actually inaccurate. I mean, as a kid, but see, I think this is where my view of golf probably morphed to other people's. Growing up in North Carolina, growing up in Winston-Salem, I was able to see what I call traditional PGA Tour events. Back in those days, used to be the GGO, now it's the Wyndham.
Okay.
I would see the Vantage Senior Championship, which would come to Tanglewood, which is where I started playing. And I would see all of the pros. I mean, I would see the Arnold Palmers, the Jack Nicklauses. I would see the Charlie Sifferts. And then at my local course, which is 15 minutes away, I would see other athletes. I would see, you know, Al Wood. I've seen Althea Gibson, Jim Thorpe, Chuck Thorpe, Lee Elder. All these people that their golf games were absolutely amazing. You know, Al Wood wasn't a professional golfer. He played basketball, but he played at Carolina. And if you grew up where I did, I mean, the Hills were king. You know, so having an opportunity to see the Althea Gibson, I mean, she won Wimbledon. Not only did she win Wimbledon, but then she was a professional golfer.
Yeah,
to see all those people come through Winston-Salem gave me a different perspective, because there was no one that could tell me black people weren't great golfers. That was bull. I see it. I had seen it, and I see it. So I knew Jim Thorpe, Chuck Thorpe, his brothers. I knew they were all good players. And then I looked at my dad in that same perspective. My dad was a heck of a player. Heck of a player. And so I've seen my dad shoot 64.
Yeah.
So you can't tell me. I mean, as a little boy, I knew that black folks could play. So that narrative never really resonated with me. And I think it's probably why I was able to see golf broadly, because I realized that black and white were very good at the sport. We just needed to give black more of an opportunity.
So moving forward, we get to like 1998. So I'm kind of following your timeline here. You become the executive director of East Lake Junior Golf Academy in Atlanta.
Right.
Tell me about your work there.
Well, if you can imagine going into a neighborhood that's one way in, one way out, dealing with a bevy of young people that didn't have a father in their lives, and their parents, their mothers weren't very trusting of the system in general, not just educational system, but socioeconomic system. I mean, you got to think about it. You know, if you can imagine having a neighborhood with no banks, no grocery stores, no restaurants, had a Kentucky Fried Chicken on the corner, no positive means of economic relief outside of $100 million a year drug trade. $100 million a year drug trade.
Yeah.
When I tell you it was insane, it was insane. But first day on the job for me, I met the mailman, a guy named Rick. And Rick walked up to me and he said, "Hey, you must be new." I said, "Yeah, I am." He said, he gave me this quizzical look. He said, "Do you even know anything about this neighborhood?" I said, "I researched it a little bit." I said, "But I see a beautiful golf course, East Lake Golf Course right here, across, literally across the street, like a rock's throw." And I said, "I know we're going to build one on the other side of the street." He said, he pulled his shirt up. And it's funny, I wrote about this in my book. He pulled his shirt up and he showed me his 9mm.
Yeah. Oh, man.
He said, "I don't deliver mail without this." I said, "So that's your American Express card." He said, "You better believe it. I don't leave home without it." And that's when I realized that it was a really troubled area. I mean,
yeah.
You hate to say you were there, then you realize it. I could have probably researched it on the front end, but there's no way I would have met Rick on the front end reading it in a book. I mean, East Lake was a very troubled place, but it had the genius was behind what was coming. I mean, there were people sitting at the top saying, "Hey, we're going to change." You know, Tom Cousins, Mr. Cousins had a belief and a vision, which to me should probably go down in history as one of the best visionary projects of all time in the world, I think. And so his vision, being able to hire people and put in place and bring me in, and then we go, you know, I went door to door. I knocked on parents' doors and said, "Hey, I'm here. If you trust your child spending afternoons with me, I can teach them golf. I can help them go to college."
That's pretty cool.
And those moms looked at me and said, "We're going to do it." I didn't expect it like that, but they said, "Okay." And sure enough, I did it. I sent their kids to college playing golf. So for me, it's to this day, I'm still really, really close to those East Lake students, really close. And it's probably the only thing that prompted me to get into coaching, because I wanted to see, after all of the success that I had at East Lake, if I could do the same thing with traditional students,
mm-hmm,
who weren't necessarily black. So it was kind of some ego for me, like, okay, you've done this now in the community. You've had a lot of success and a lot of kids at college. Those kids have gathered some wins. Now, can you do this with white kids in college who don't seem to share your background? And once I got on the college level, I realized there's no difference.
Yeah,
there's just absolutely no difference.
How old were you when you were at East Lake? Like, what? When did you start there?
I was 27.
Yeah, because I feel like in your 20s, like you, that's when you got this energy. You know, can just pour into people, right place, right time.
So. Oh yeah, you at 27, you're ready to fight.
Yeah,
27, you have that energy. You're probably not going to take no for an answer.
Yep.
You're willing to buck the system a little more. You're willing to take more risks, take more chances. And everything I'm describing is Sam. That was me. I was not afraid. If it came down to helping a young person, I was willing to go to bat for it, regardless of the consequences. I was willing to look out for the young person.
Yeah. It's what kids need. They just need someone to look out for them somewhere along the way, whether it's a parent or a mentor, coach.
100%.
So you spent 8 years at East Lake investing in the lives of others.
Yep.
And I know that you were the teacher, you were the mentor.
Sure.
But I'm curious, are there lessons that you learned from these kids?
Oh, absolutely. Because the one thing I learned too is that there is an innate resilience in that person with nothing. If you can imagine, we as people take for granted, you know, we see students at private schools, we see students join these country clubs, we see students that might be on the street trying to clean your windows for a dollar if you stop at an intersection, And there are so many negative things that go through your mind. When in fact, if you take those same people, given the opportunity and the proper resource, you could change their lives. Those students literally reiterated in me that, you know what, God has a purpose for all of us. And it was such a blessing for me, because the more I poured into them, I did it. I wasn't looking for anything in return.
Mm-hmm.
And what I realized very quickly is that those students were the exact same as the Stanford students, as the Michigan State students, as the Queen students. They're the same. The color, the only difference was the melanin in their skin. And I took from those kids that we all need that resilience. We all need that extra fight. We all need that edge. Even students from the best homes in America, it's going to be difficult for them to excel and to make it if they don't have that same Eastlake edge.
Mm-hmm.
That edge sometimes that will get you over the hump in a very tough time.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. So you wrote a book about your time at Eastlake called Diamonds in the Rough. Tell my listeners what they could expect if they pick up a copy of this book.
I'll tell you what, you realize the resilience of the human spirit. You realize the power of God. You realize that, like Sam Cooke said, changes are coming. I mean, you realize that there are young people, all of our young people need support. If we can place proper resources in these communities, all of these young people can be successful. There's no question about it. And the book highlights different scenarios, different instances. It starts out with a false arrest, which was insane. So I'll give your listeners a brief nugget. Imagine this: four students playing golf, standing on a green. Police ride up in golf carts, walk on the green, arrest two of the four players, take them to jail. When you sit back and try to digest really what just happened, a guy sitting at home watching the news and reading the newspaper, he sees the pictures of four kids getting ready to sign to go to college. He says, two of those guys robbed me when I was playing golf. He described one guy as 5'8", and he described one guy as 5'9", kind of chunky, with twists in their hair. The two young men arrested, which of course were two of my guys, one guy was 6'5", and one guy was 6'3½". And they were both slim as a string bean. But the police took the word of a president of a SunTrust bank, a white guy, over the word of young black men. So the system was automatically skewed against these students. They never had an opportunity. That's the beginning of the book.
That's insane, man. I don't even have any words. It's terrible.
I wanted people to understand the power. There is a power in these communities that is so strong. The occupants of the community, the kids of the community, they have no control over it. If a man can pick up the phone, because the system is not built to support and respect communities like Eastlake. They look down on communities like that. Now, if you look at Eastlake, you're looking at a situation where it's one of the best areas in Atlanta. The public school there, when I first got there, was the worst in the state. Now the school there is the best in the state. Whereas you could have bought a house on Second Avenue, which is right there in front of the course, for $30,000 or $40,000 when I first got there. Now a house on that street costs you about $850,000. So there's no Kentucky Fried Chicken, none of that stuff. So Mr. Cousins asked me one day, he said, Sam, he said, can I ask you something? I said, yes, sir. He said, what would happen if I tore down all of the payphones in this neighborhood? He said, would that stop the drug presence? I said, it would definitely help. This was back in the days when people were using pagers. So you're looking at a visionary like a Tom Cousins. You're taking these young people who are no different than you and I. And all I was trying to do was give them some level of hope and belief. That's it.
So I know, I mean, I've looked at the first few chapters of the book, and it's kind of filled with some Bible references.
Yeah.
What role does your faith play in who you are and how you view others?
100%. It allows me to forgive others because they know not what they do. I mean, I could tell you some of the devil I deal with on a daily basis, people coming at you. My faith allows me to forgive them and look over that stuff. It allows me to look at a young person and not hold judgment. It allows me to continue to believe that we are all inherently good regardless of our situation and the things that happen to us. So for me, my faith is everything.
It seems like so many of the people that are doing powerful things or have a legacy of doing powerful things are pulling from their faith. Like they view people a different way.
Right.
And I got, that sense when I was kind of digging into who you are. Shifting gears here. We could talk about your successes at Stanford, Michigan State, Queens University. And this includes a national championship, a Big Ten championship, Coach of the Year honors. But I really want to talk about Howard University and how you ended up there. So in 2021, after a long hiatus of several decades, Howard relaunched its golf program. And the Genesis story is pretty cool. Can you share that with our listeners?
Yeah, so for my part, Howard, I give a young, there's a young man named Otis Ferguson IV. Otis was on the team this spring. For his last additional year. And Otis, in basically some serendipitous moment, Otis was on campus. Stephen Curry had come to campus. Stephen had just done a piece on a very unfortunate piece on the people that were killed at the church in Charleston.
Yeah.
And Otis was at the presentation, and Otis walks up to Stephen and says, hey, Mr. Curry, I would love to talk to you. We could benefit from a golf program. And one thing led to another. They exchanged information, emails, yada, yada, yada. And from there, a program was born. And so as time waned, and you take it a year later, when I got a couple of calls and said, would I be interested in the opportunity? I said, absolutely. Because I realized at that point I had played golf with Stephen years before that. And the thing I did remember from him was how competitive he was. And I knew if his name was attached to something, he was gonna want to win. No
sure.
question about it. And so that excited me because at that point I said, I want to win. I had been offered multiple coaching jobs prior to coming to Howard. But I didn't want to just get back into coaching just to coach. I mean, I've done that. I've won a Big Ten. I've won a national championship. I've won a couple Coach of the Years. I've won 5 conference championships. I've done all that. But to me, it was about doing something bigger than me and something that was just not on the normal beaten path. So getting an opportunity to come to a place and start from scratch and build a program like no one else has ever seen, with a lot of young people that, would be deserving of an opportunity like this, was very exciting, actually.
Yeah. You seem really cool and collected. Like, you don't seem like you have big highs and lows. If I were in your shoes, so I tried to put myself in your shoes for a minute, and I get the call for this opportunity, I'm thinking about a couple of different factors. So the first factor, you got Steph Curry, one of the biggest names in basketball, funding the first 6 years of the program. Second factor, you're going to be leading one of only 25 historically black colleges and universities that has a golf team. Third factor, you've got to convince recruits that this new program is happening and that they should choose to be a part of it instead of going to an already established program. So when I think of like that pros and cons list, the word pressure is what comes to mind for me. Like, do you feel the pressure of your role?
Oh, absolutely. You feel it. But I love it though. I mean, I get off on that. I mean, to me, I like Plato. I like building something, making something out of nothing. I like proving people wrong.
Yeah.
Again, it's what I told you 10 minutes ago. I like bucking the system. I like fighting the bully, you know? So for people to, I love when people say, well, they can't or you can't, I love it.
Yeah.
I never articulate out loud. I'll show them. I love to show them. And so for me, I looked at the Howard opportunity. Like, okay, let's show people what we can do with proper resources. And then it kind of went back to what, it went back to the phone call my brother and I had. He said to me years ago, right before he got out of coaching, he said, you've given a lot of your life coaching at a lot of predominantly white institutions. He said, one day you should consider coaching at a black college.
Yeah.
And I said to him, I wouldn't be interested coaching at a black college if the black college couldn't muster up what I felt like were proper resources to be honest with the students.
Mm-hmm.
When this opportunity came forward, I said, here's an opportunity to treat these students like they're supposed to be treated. And so my goal was to come back east and build a Stanford golf program east. That's how I look at what I'm building at Howard. I'm trying to build Stanford east.
Very cool.
So GPAs in my men's program and women's program are super high, and I have some really good players.
Well, you know, it seems like you've gotten off to a good start. I watched a recent Steph Curry Callaway golf video where he referred to you as literally one of the greatest coaches in the game right now. So that's pretty high praise.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I appreciate him saying it. I grind. I work hard. I promise you that. I work really hard, and I try to stay as centered and humble as possible because I can't do it alone. I need that village. You know, Stephen is a part of that village, and I need that village and the community and the villages around the country to help support this endeavor to help these students be as successful as they can be. I mean, one person can't do it. I can promise you that.
So you've gotten to interact with Stephen Curry a little bit. If ESPN called you up to give some thoughts on Steph, what would be some of your highlights?
My first comment would be from a historical perspective, I would have to say he's got to rank in the top as it relates to inspiring change. The man is phenomenal. I mean, let's be honest here. Like, yeah, he's the greatest shooter in the game, no question. Greatest shooter in the world. But to me, when you think about the inspiration and the change, the things that he set forth in communities around, I mean, it's pretty unbelievable. I mean, what he's doing in the lives of these students here at Howard is fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
He's been doing stuff like this in Oakland. He's been doing stuff like this back in Charlotte. He's a Carolina guy like I am. I tell you what, I mean, transformational leader is what I would say. Transformational leader.
Yeah. And that, I think that would have to be the highest praise, right? I mean, to be 100%. In a position where you have influence and to use it in a positive way.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Very cool. So you're responsible for both the men's and women's teams at Howard University.
Yep.
Do the teams practice together? Do they practice separately? What's your approach to practice? Kind of give us a look behind the scenes.
Well, we do both. We practice some together, some separately. My look at it is, I'm basically running a men's company and a women's company, and they all have, I have individual business people within that company. So yeah, we are a team, but I'm treating each person individually. So yeah, we will have a practice. A perfect example is today, you know, it's, what is it, 28 degrees outside. So we're going to have practice out today, and practice will start from 3 to 5. But I have some people I'm meeting at 2:30. We're going to put some people between 3 and 5 are working on different things. I have TrackMan for a couple. I have other things I'm working on with a couple of other ones. And we're all doing, we're doing practice, but we're doing different things within a practice.
Gotcha.
We work out on Tuesdays, and right now we're working out on Tuesdays and Thursdays as a group, as a unit. They have the option to get in an additional day or two of lift if they work through the trainer, and that's going well. But then at the same time, we also practice separately as well. Guys will go a place, and the ladies will go a place. So we work pretty hard. We stay pretty busy. And from there, it has developed a nice culture. We have a great culture here. And that was always, for me, that was always the most important, developing a great culture.
Yeah. Does the men's team have different challenges to confront when you think about opponents than the women's team? Or is it really just the same thing?
I think it's the same thing. I mean, because the men have played just a tad bit longer than the women here, literally a year longer, the men are probably a year further in the development of what I think they can be. Next year should be a really, really peaked year for them. The women, in my estimation right now, that starting this past semester, were brand new. So they're dealing with new program challenges. I just hired an assistant coach. She just started last week. So now that's new as well. So by May, that culmination will be pretty rock solid. And so starting the fall of 22, I feel like in my mind, it would be that first real year of now let's go really, really compete for the women. The guys, the expectation is to right now, they're better for, they're very competitive right now. I mean, we almost won our last event, lost by a stroke. One of my guys actually won the last event. He shot 10 under and won that event. But I've had three tournament winners here so far, and that being the case, we're definitely vibing in the right direction right now. And so I had set each year up to be a development on the next. So mm-hmm. last year we got off to a blazing start, which helped us, which then set us really, really in a pretty good spot for this year. It's like we're currently ranked as the number one rated HBCU in the country right now. And then next year will be even better. So I've just been incrementally improving what we have to be where we want to be.
Yeah, very cool. Who's number two? Just out of curiosity.
That's a good question. I don't worry about who behind us.
Sure.
Low idea.
You kind of gave a hint at some of these things, but what are your expectations for this year or the next few years? Like, what are you shooting for?
Yeah, my goal, honestly, within the next 2 years is for the guys to really have a chance to win a conference title, whether it's this year, next year, or both. And for the ladies specifically starting next year and the year after, for them to have a chance to win at least one or two conference championships. That's the goal. I'm building it up towards conference championships. And then if we win conference, we can make it to nationals. But I've also built it up to where we play a really, really competitive, really, really good schedule where we see a solid mid-major schedule, but yet at the same time, we play in a couple of events where we see the best teams in America. Mm-hmm. And so that's huge because I think in order to be the best, you have to see what the best look like.
Yeah.
And so we've been blessed in order to see some really, really good programs and great players. And so now I think it has also crafted a nice narrative with my guys and even some of my ladies. Like, they're working really hard. They know what's out there now. They know, they've seen it. And I don't have to, you know, it's one thing to tell a person, yeah, if you do this, then you can compete with this person. Well, these kids have already played against those people. So I don't have to sell them on that dream anymore. Now it's like, okay, coach, we know what it's going to take. Now let's go get it.
Cool. Well, I'll be keeping an eye on you. I'll be rooting for you.
Please do.
When's your next match? When does that happen?
For the guys, it's in March. It's mid-March. It's here in Maryland. Up in Frederick, Maryland, and for the ladies is late March. So we have about another 6 weeks to really get ready, which is great considering the weather we get up here. So we have about 6 weeks to get ready.
Okay. Do you have snow on the ground up there still?
No. There's no snow on the ground right now, but it's just chilly.
Now I'm thinking about like recruiting. If there's a talented golfer that wants to get on your radar, how do they get your attention?
I would ask him to either call me or just send me an email. I respond to every email. No exception. Every email I respond to. So if they send me something, And most people that really know me will tell you, say, yeah, that man doesn't sleep at all. I mean, I got an email from one of my people last night, West Coast. It was about 2 o'clock my time. I hit him right back. You know, and I know they laugh because they know I'm always available.
Yeah.
I feel like I want to work when everybody else is asleep.
Well, this has been great. Thanks for all the stuff that you've shared. Thanks for giving up some of your time. I'd love to end with a 5-question lightning round if you're up for it.
Sure.
All right, let's do it. So question one, what's your go-to golf club or what club do you hit the best?
I love the putt. I feel like I can putt with anybody in the world.
Love period. It. So, man, this kind of kills my number two question, but I'm going to ask it to you anyway. If you had to pick, would you prefer killer distance off the tee or an above average putting game?
Well, above average putting game, number one. And then the second thing I would say would be 106 yards. That's a perfect 56 degree wedge.
Yeah. I ran a par 3 course for a couple of years, so I'm with you. That's the
okay.
That's the next thing. All right, question three. What's the coolest course that you've ever played personally?
I would give you two based on experience. I would say one would be Augusta National. And then two, playing it with my dad, would be St. Andrews.
Very cool. Question four. Who's your favorite golfer to watch?
Right now?
Yeah.
That's actually a tough question. I like watching them all, but it's fun to watch. Like right now, I would say I love watching Joseph Bramlett. I mean, he played for me. He played for me at Stanford. He's had two great weeks the last 2 weeks. So I love watching Joe play. But also love watching these college players play. I mean, they would be my favorite. I mean, I love seeing them advance and get better week in, week out.
All right, final lightning round question. If you were to give one book recommendation other than Diamonds in the Rough, of course, what would it be?
The Bible. Because I really believe the answers are there. You can twist them, manipulate them any kind of way you want, but the good book is there for a reason.
Can't argue with that.
No.
All right, Sam, thanks for taking the time. Is there anything you'd like to plug?
No, thanks for your time. And I think if you're a young person, if you're a parent of a young person, and you want them to have an incredibly unique experience, something that's life-altering, something that's life-changing, competing against the best, really changing history, regardless of where you live, regardless of what you look like, give me a call. Howard is your place. We're changing lives, one swing, one person, one step at a time.
Love it. All right, everyone. Thanks for tuning in. Be sure to check out gettingoffcourse.com to see the show notes. Or listen to past episodes. We'll put a link to Sam's book there as well.
Thank you.
You can also send me an email at gettingoffcourse@gmail.com. Getting Off Course is presented by Par 3 Near Me. Visit par3nearme.com to find a Par 3 or executive golf course near you.